This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Unit 5 school administrators are facing increasing mental health issues among elementary children.
Maybe throwing something or just very aggressive in their actions, behavior where they become uncontrollable.
Superintendent Mark Daniel tells GLT's Charlie Schlinker even two or three troubled children per building can change a school environment. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin talks with GLT's Ryan Denham about the Alabama election, the GOP tax bill, and more. And Laura Kennedy delves into keeping political conversations civil during holiday gatherings. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's December 14th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from country financial representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The superintendent of Unit 5 schools is sounding an alarm over elementary school mental health issues. Mark Daniel tells GLT's Charlie Schlinker he's getting strong feedback from principals that there's a problem with kids who behave unlike most their age and in very unhealthy and atypical ways.
We're not talking mental health from the standpoint of from a clinical standpoint. As far as do we have residency programs or non-residency programs, and where are the psychiatrists and where are the psychologists in this mix? It's really about what kind of behavior are we seeing in our classrooms that is fundamentally different than what we've seen in the past.
Are there danger signs?
There are some signs that we're seeing some fundamental differences in our classrooms. For instance, behavior of kindergartners and first graders, which, if you've ever been in a kindergarten classroom, it's always about how to create boundaries and what are you doing to create patterns of behavior with kids. And usually kindergartners will eventually understand these are the boundaries and these
Here's
are the patterns
limit.
and they will conform to those. And, the teacher demonstrates, you have a student demonstrate, and then you have the whole class demonstrate. So this is how we sit. This is how we get in small groups. This is how we, all those things.
Little Johnny gets in trouble once or twice for kissing little Sarah
and then
it's done.
It's
done. A developmental thing.
But now we're seeing rather behavior that becomes very disruptive. It might be behavior where student is maybe throwing something or just very aggressive in their actions, behavior where they become uncontrollable, and even through proper, we go through extensive training for our teachers and administrators on how to properly restrain a child.
Are these kids people who should be special ed kids or not?
Well, when you start kindergarten, you haven't yet identified, so there is a process. But we're finding it's not just quote a special needs issue. It's going across all our socioeconomic groups. There are no boundaries here or lines that we can say this is unique to this population or that population.
What's the frequency of that sort of behavior?
Well, again, if you think one, two, or three students in a building, that can create major disruption.
That can change a classroom environment.
It can change a classroom environment. It can change a school's environment and the climate of a school. So we need to really... We are now at the point where we're saying, how do we create a programming or an intervention program that speaks to addressing that immediate need? And once we see the immediate need, working not just with the child, but also with wraparound programs. So we're also working with the family. Because, it happens not only in school, it certainly is happening at home as well, and we can't just separate the two.
If these are recurrent patterns of behavior among different kids across ethnic and economic backgrounds, what is going on? What is the source of this behavior?
Well, some people say it's trauma, and that trauma can be both physical or emotional. It could be, and they call that adverse childhood experience. There's actual studies in regards to that. We call it ACEs. Matter of fact, our association, of our teachers' association, which is locally it's UFIA, but statewide it's our affiliated with NEA, but they are actually looking at, there are specific programs that they're examining and trying to implement across the country. We're seeing this across the country. I don't know why this is happening, but I can tell you from my own personal experience. My father-in-law is a retired psychiatrist, and over the past 5 to 10 years, he's seen a marked difference in behavior of adolescent and of early childhood. And we don't know really what the issue is, but it is different, and we need to address it. And then, of course, you know, we do have limited resources in our community due to lack of mental health professionals and how to deal with that.
The county is starting to develop programming for adults.
Yes.
Who's going to develop the programming for kids? And do you need to partner with somebody about that?
Well, you know, both Unit 5 and District 87 have come together already and had a discussion, because we have a problem. We have this, or should I say, we need to be able to work through this and find solutions for our kids. By the way, ACEs, you can work with this child and the child can improve, because it really is a neurological effect. So you can have a rebound. You can improve that child just through certain processes with that child.
How long a road is that?
Well, we don't know the length, to be honest, but the point is, does it have to be long-term? No. Can it be short-term? Yes. And it depends upon the student and the situation. But I'm encouraged that both 87 and Unit 5 are coming together to have this discussion, because it's happening in our districts. And I'm going to tell you, I've talked to other superintendents. It's across the state. And I'm still keep touch with other states. It's across the Midwest and across our country.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking, as we do periodically, with Unit 5 School Superintendent Mark Daniel. How urgent is this? How fast do you want to develop programming and an agreement and perhaps reach out to the county for part of the funding to make it a holistic youth-to-adult effort?
So we've also met with the county in regards to this issue. They have a plan in place that they're trying to implement. But let's be honest, they're limited resources as well. And I'm thinking that probably Unit 5 and 87 need to come together to solve some of these issues internally and then continue to look for outside resources. But we need to take care of this problem. I would say it's urgent. And having spent some times, some afternoons just recently with our teachers, I'll tell you, the physical and emotional strain on our educators is visible. It's noticeable. We need to take this very serious.
How soon are you hoping for programming to enter the various buildings?
Well, we just had a principal meeting this morning with all of our administrators, and talking with several of them, as well as my director of special ed, we're planning on getting together, hopefully having even something coming back from the holiday break.
That's fast.
That's fast. We don't know, in regards to the specialists, perhaps a counselor, teacher, or guidance counselor at the elementary level? And again, we're focusing right now on the elementary. Is it a social worker? Is it a hybrid of the two? Is it a behavioral specialist? It's going to be a very unique position, because this is a very unique problem.
Well, if you are talking 2 to 3 kids per building in both District 87 and Unit 5, that sounds like more than one person.
And it could be. And we talked about that particular scenario. I mean, and do we have a unique location for those students?
I was going to say, you can't get through building visits to all those people in a week. And what we're talking about is, I assume, relatively intense intervention on a short-term basis.
Correct. Now, we do have some buildings who have a hybrid program running to address behavior of this level. But do we need another site, or do we need a third site that's now a site where both 87 and 5 come together?
Well, do you want to take these kids out of the classroom and take them to a separate site?
You may have to do that. Now, we have to be careful with that because, again, I mean, that's the level of behavior we're talking about.
And that these are not classified as special ed kids.
No, they're not classified as special ed kids.
May not be.
It may not be.
It's something else.
Yes, it's something else. And that's why I would call it mental health, because it is, it's how do we make that child healthy again in regards to their brain development, and in regards to their being able to handle social situations, and also how do they handle frustration, all these pieces coming together. That's a unique person. We have ideas, but those people are also being used to do a lot of other things in our district. At first, we thought maybe this could be something happening in the maybe next year, next fall. But I'm thinking after my visits, and I'm nearly visited, I almost finished with all my, school visits for this part of the first semester. I'll say that it is a top priority, and we need to address it as soon as possible.
Unit 5 School District Superintendent Mark Daniel spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Hear Daniel next week talk about the health dangers of football and the high school's marching band merger. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, proud to serve you from his new office in historic downtown Bloomington. Justin offers life insurance options to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, how to navigate political discussions during holiday gatherings. Needed advice for the season ahead during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Generous tax cuts for corporations and the wealthiest Americans would be delivered in a sweeping overhaul of the tax laws under a new agreement crafted by Republicans in Congress. Middle and low-income families would receive smaller tax cuts, though President Donald Trump and Republican leaders have billed the package as a huge benefit for the middle class. The agreement reached Wednesday combines key elements of separate tax bills recently passed by the House and Senate, striking compromises on some of them. Republicans are pushing to deliver the final legislation to President Trump before Christmas. Illinois' senior Democratic Senator Dick Durbin doesn't like what he sees. GLT's Ryan Denham spoke with Durbin by phone from Washington this morning.
On Wednesday, there was news that House and Senate negotiators had reached an agreement on a final version of the bill, even if the details of that agreement are not really known yet. What do you know about how this final bill looks?
Well, I can tell you that the details of the bill have not been disclosed to members of Congress. We are leaving for the week. We'll be returning next week, and on Monday or Tuesday, asked to vote on it. I will tell you, based on my experience, I can guarantee you that finally, a week or two from now, someone's going to read the detailed language and say, whoops, we made some mistakes. And when you think about the tax code that affects the economy of our country, every business, every family, every individual, we should take the time to get it right as best we can. Unfortunately, that's not the approach that's been used here. It's been done on an expedited, fast basis, and I'm afraid that at least the way we're doing it raises serious questions about the value of the product.
At this point, is there anything that Democrats like you can do if they have concerns to shape this thing, or is it pretty much in Republican leadership hands?
No, this is strictly a partisan measure, and they use a process used around here rarely, but it's become kind of common, called reconciliation. And what it basically means is the Republicans don't need to work with anybody. They just force it through. If they can get their ranks to support it, they don't need Democratic votes. There are four Republican senators, as we speak at this moment, who are still uncertain about what they'll do. If any three of them vote against it, then the whole process stops. But there are no Democrats in the Senate who have supported this measure. And the reason's obvious. Any proposal for tax changes that gives massive tax giveaways to the wealthy, and I might add the conference committee cut taxes on the wealthiest Americans even more, tax breaks to big corporations, adds $1.4 trillion to our national debt for our kids to pay back, and fundamentally challenges the future of Medicare and Medicaid, that kind of approach is not going to get bipartisan support from Democrats.
You've had some serious concerns about the House and Senate versions as they've moved through to passage. So other than process, what are your top concerns as of how it looks today?
I'm for tax reform. I'm for tax cuts. But here's how it should have been done. We should have taken a look at some of the provisions of the tax code now that are just giveaways, something called carried interest, which gives some of the wealthiest people in this country reduced tax rates when they frankly haven't done anything to earn them. That most people, even candidate Trump, came out against carried interest. That could have been eliminated, and the savings from that could have been used to reduce the tax burden of middle-income families. That's where I would have gone. Make this progressive. Do you know how many wealthy Americans from Illinois have knocked on my door and said we desperately need a tax cut? None. Not one. And yet that is the highest priority in this bill. I think it's a mistake. And I think our kids and grandkids may look back and say, how did this deficit get worse in 2017? Didn't they know they were leaving us with the responsibility of paying for tax cuts for wealthy people?
What's the latest with the individual mandate from the Affordable Care Act? One version of the bill had it removed, the other didn't. Will that make it through? And if it does, what do you think that'll mean for impact on American health care?
I know what impact it'll have. It means 13 million Americans will lose their health insurance, including a lot in Illinois, and that the cost of health insurance premiums is going to go up 10 to 20% because of that provision. Here's what it says. Everybody in this country has an obligation to buy health insurance. If you decide not to, you pay a penalty. If they buy health insurance, it turns out many people, particularly in lower income categories, get a pretty healthy, strong subsidy for their health insurance premium. So we tried to give a reward or an incentive for lower-income folks to buy health insurance and say to those who are just adamant they're not going to buy it, there's a price to pay. Why do we do this? Because we know when you look at the insurance pool, the people who are signing up for insurance, there'll be a lot of older and sicker people who desperately need insurance and will sign up quickly. The younger invincibles are the ones who don't sign up. When you have a pool with largely older and sicker people in it, the premiums are going to be expensive. When you bring in balancing in that pool by having younger, healthier people, it starts to bring the premiums down. So the Republicans have said in the Senate, we're going to get rid of the mandate. And as a consequence, we know it'll happen. In premiums, health insurance premiums for Illinoisans and many Americans are going to go up 10 to 20%.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm on the line with Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, talking about the GOP tax plan. 2 weeks ago, a Canadian agricultural equipment manufacturer named Brandt Industries announced it was opening its first plant in the U.S., just outside of Normal here. I spoke with Brandt's president, and he said his decision to do that was influenced by this tax overhaul. He likes what it's signaling, particularly on the corporate tax rate. This is hundreds of jobs being created here. What's your response to that kind of comment from the business community?
I'm not surprised at what he said, and I certainly would have added in my list of things to do in tax reform, making sure that the corporate tax is not paid primarily by smaller and medium-sized companies. Right now, the tax code is written in a way that the biggest, wealthiest corporations end up with lots of friends and lots of attorneys and lots of advocates in Washington, and they get breaks on the tax code that smaller and medium-sized corporations don't receive. And so companies like the one you just mentioned probably falls in the medium to small corporate range. They end up paying the top rate, and the biggest companies, General Electric, paid zero in federal taxes a few years ago. What I think, if you're going to have fairness in the tax code and a corporate tax, which I support, it ought to be done so that the smaller and medium-sized companies, like the one you mentioned, don't end up carrying the burden. What they've done in this tax code reform is to give the tax break to the wealthiest, as the biggest corporations, and some of it to the smaller and medium-sized corporations. So from my point of view, they could have done this a lot better and encouraged businesses just like the one you mentioned to expand and to bring jobs to our state.
You've been critical of the GLP tax plan for the changes it could make to state and local tax deductions, or SALT, eliminating them in some cases. You cited this in a letter that you sent to Illinois Republican House members. They shot back that the majority of middle-income taxpayers in Illinois don't see a benefit from those deductions because they're only available to those who's itemized. What's your response to that, and why, in your opinion, are state and local tax deductions so important for Illinois?
We start started with the basic idea. You should never have to pay a tax on a tax. If you pay $1,000 in property taxes on your home, you shouldn't be taxed on that $1,000. That's been a principle that's guided us for years, and it's basically going away with this Republican tax change. It means that those of us in states like Illinois, where we have a state income tax, state sales taxes, as well as property taxes, are going to end up paying taxes on those taxes paid. 20 to 25%, depending on where you live in the state, of the people who file their federal taxes itemize. In other words, they go through and look at what they actually spent as opposed to taking the standard deduction. Their taxes are going to go up. And I've said to my colleagues from the state of Illinois who were in the House and supporting this, why would you want to raise taxes on your own people? Why should you ask the people you represent to pay a tax on a tax? And I haven't gotten very far, to be totally honest with you. I think that there's a reason why the realtors of our state oppose this provision, why the home builders oppose this provision, why we have those who are interested in creating jobs and wealth and working families oppose it. It really is short-sighted to put this new tax burden on the people of Illinois. I don't know how those congressmen will come home and explain it.
It looks like the election of Democrat Doug Jones in Alabama won't have any immediate impact on the tax bill because he won't be seated until after the new year. But what was your reaction to his election this week?
Amazing to think that we elected a Democratic senator in the state of Alabama. For goodness sakes, why did it happen? Well, first, the Republican candidate was seriously flawed. Allegations made against him raised many concerns about his fitness to serve in the Senate. And some of the statements, public statements he's made during the course of his public career led to his being censured twice on the Alabama Supreme Court and really raised a question as to whether he even represented conservative Alabama. The second thing is, just like Virginia a few weeks before, people are kind of sending a message. They don't like what they see coming out of the Trump White House in Washington. And so we saw groups come forward in numbers that had never been seen before. African-American voters, women voters, younger voters, who are just saying they were protesting what they see happening in Washington, the change vote, if you will. Put those together, and it was an upset victory. A close one, 2 points, but an upset victory that nobody would have predicted just a few months back. I called Doug Jones yesterday. I congratulated him and said I look forward to serving. I think he'll probably be sworn in after the first of the year.
How do you think Doug Jones' election will change the battlefield in 2018? Does this give Democrats a chance to actually win back the Senate?
Well, I think it does show that there are forces at work in the American electorate who were unhappy with the outcome in the presidential election, have been unhappy with some of the policies coming out of this administration, and are going to get involved in ways they've never been involved before. I've seen that at a grassroots level. There are groups, invincible groups and other groups that have arisen that just didn't even exist a year ago, and they have become a powerful political force. They're running candidates for office. They're promoting candidates. They're getting involved in the process. The things that in a democracy you applaud. Many years back, go back 10 years, it was the Tea Party doing much the same thing, a kind of a grassroots Republican conservative effort. Now we're seeing on the progressive side that kind of grassroots effort. I think it's healthy in a democracy.
That's Dick Durbin, the senior Democratic senator from Illinois, talking about the Republican tax plan. I'm Ryan Denham.
Central Illinois Republican Congressman Rodney Davis and Darren LaHood supported the House version of the bill when it passed last month. Davis has raised concerns about a provision that would treat graduate student tuition waivers as taxable income. Multiple media outlets are reporting that provision will not make it into the final version. Ahead during Sound Ideas, hear about efforts to navigate news and information in the age of fake news or alleged fake news. That's ahead during Sound Ideas. Tomorrow on the show, hear the music of the seasons, but not the Christmas season. Seasons, the Four Seasons. And it's not the famous Four Seasons by Antonio Vivaldi. It's the Four Seasons of Buenos Aires. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Illinois Symphony Orchestra music director Ken Lamb about Saturday's concert. It includes the music of Argentinian composer Astor Piazzolla. You're listening to it now. preview of the Illinois Symphony Orchestra concert on Saturday. More tomorrow during Sound Ideas.
As the pace of news quickens, Morning Edition moves faster.
That my service in the Senate will conclude at the end of my term in early January.
As the story gets more complex, we step back and break it down.
The grand jury indictment accuses them of working on behalf of you.
And when you need a break, we take a breath.
Snoop Dogg stars in a new version of the Joker's Wild, calibrated to speak to
him. Be ready for your day. Wake up to Morning Edition tomorrow.
Hear Morning Edition Monday through Friday, now starting at 4 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Brad Barker Honda, where the service experts have more than 200 years combined experience. Whether it's routine maintenance or a problem, Brad Barker's qualified technicians can help. More information available at bradbarkerhonda.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's customary to exchange gifts with friends and family during the holiday season, but there's something else that can be exchanged when we gather together. That's heated, divisive political rhetoric. It doesn't have to be that way. A difference of opinion on political matters does not have to ruin your holiday. Laura Kennedy has more.
Yes, it is possible to talk politics and not lambast someone who holds a differing opinion. That's according to Joseph Zampetti, a professor of rhetoric and political communication at Illinois State University's School of Communication. His new book, Divisive Discourse, focuses not on what liberals or conservatives think, but how they go about expressing what they think.
How do they try to persuade people to think like they do? So what are the fallacies, the types of reasonings, the techniques and strategies that people use when discussing politics?
Well, you've been focused on this topic for a chunk of your career. Have you been seeing a major change, a major shift in rhetoric coming on, or has it been sudden?
Now, that's a great question. I think ever since I've been studying it, there has been, quite a bit of acrimony and, vitriol and that sort of thing. We've seen the past several presidential cycles, for example, a lot of negative campaign ads. We see that at the local level, too, of course. I will say that, and I think most people would agree with me on this, that the 2016 presidential election was kind of to the extreme, that we really saw people pull out the stops on both sides of the political spectrum, really getting nasty and not sticking to the issues. Making a lot of personal character attacks, using other types of techniques and fallacious reasoning to try to get their point across. And I think that, unfortunately, seen an escalation of that kind of acrimony.
Well, why is it escalating? Why are we losing nuanced rhetoric?
I think there are a variety of factors. One is, folks at GLT may not want to hear this, but I think
you can blame the media.
I think the media have a part. I don't want to blame them entirely, but I think that they have a part. And it's not just the folks that are in the media. I think it's also the types of platforms, the type of media.
And example, a 24-hour news cycle.
Exactly.
Which has to be fed.
Right. Absolutely. And, there's this constant pursuit of trying to get be the first on the scene or get the first story and so forth. So there's the 24-hour news cycle. There's also social media platforms, which I think encourage folks to say what's on their mind with very little repercussions. It's easy to share hyperlinks without questioning the veracity of the sources. So, yeah, that's what I mean by media, not just, particular
not
media
just mainstream
people,
media.
And not just mainstream media, but media writ large, including the types of platforms. But I also think that there are some structures in place that have encouraged this kind of discourse. And, for example, gerrymandering. And it doesn't matter if it's Democrats or Republicans, but whomever is in office, whoever controls legislatures or the Congress, are able to reset boundaries for their districts, which means that if you're a Republican, for example, but you have a sliver that might be heavily Democratic, you can redraw those boundaries to kind of get rid of the Democrat segment of your district, which increases your chances of being reelected. And the Democrats have done the same thing. So what that means is if you couple that with the type of media that we have today, people are in their sort of information silos, their bubbles. We also call them echo chambers. So we self-select our exposure to information based upon what we are already thinking. And we want to be validated. Nobody wants to really be told that they're wrong or incorrect. So if we do seek out information, we tend to look for information that already agrees with us. And the same thing is true when We're looking at political candidates. So if you're already in a conservative district or a liberal district, then you're just going to kind of follow in line if your district has been redrawn for that type of candidate. So there are structural things in place, there are media things in place. And then one of the things I really drive home in the book is that I firmly believe that people just aren't taught how to have a conversation. If you really think about it, you've probably never had a class, probably never taken any formal online instruction. We enter into conversations based upon what we've seen our parents do, what we see our friends do, what we see on television and so forth, and we mimic that kind of behavior. So if the dominant voices in political conversations are yelling at one another, then the average person is going to tend to mimic that behavior as well.
So when we see Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump calling each other names or calling the people that follow them names, that's a stamp of approval, and we're going to go along with that and join in this us versus them mentality.
Absolutely. That's what it's all about, is this us versus them mentality. And so when Hillary Clinton called Trump supporters deplorables, or when Trump called Hillary a nasty woman, then the people that are already in line, right, who are already in those echo chambers, who already support Hillary or support Donald Trump, then they're going to mimic that kind of behavior too. And so if we get into a conversation with someone who happens to disagree with us, chances are that conversation is going to devolve or spiral into some sort of a yelling match, and you know that's not very productive or healthy for our democracy.
So we've basically lost the ability to just listen to somebody who holds a different opinion and go, okay, well, let's agree to disagree. That's just going by the wayside?
Absolutely. And that's what I'm really trying to challenge in my book. And that is that, you know, first of all, we often enter conversations as if it's a competition, right? Like, I need to win my argument. When in reality, we really ought to try to enter conversations by saying, you know, what can I learn from this conversation? What can I learn from the other person? Even if I disagree with them, chances are I can learn something. You know, my father is fond of saying that even a stopped clock is right twice a day. And so even somebody who's really extreme, every now and then has something positive to say or something meaningful to say. And the other thing is that when we are entering into these conversations, we need to try to remember that the other person is a human being just like us. You know, they have feelings and experiences and so forth. And often we develop our political beliefs based upon those experiences. And just because they're different doesn't mean that they don't have any value, or doesn't mean that they are somehow inferior to us. And I really think, particularly in a democracy where disagreement is always going to happen, the only way to move forward is to listen and try to find some sort of common ground.
If what we need to do is to learn how to have a conversation, but at this stage of our history, we don't want to admit we're wrong and we want to stay in our little silo, how do we break this cycle? What does the future hold for polite discourse? Is it going the way of the dodo?
I'll be honest with you. As I research this, it can be very depressing. And I often say to my colleagues and to my friends that I really enjoy my job, because one of the things that really helps me get up in the morning is our students, is the younger generation. They tend to be a little more open-minded, a little more tolerant. They tend to want to understand different perspectives. And so that gives me hope. And of course, as an educator, I want to say we can solve all of our problems through education, right? I know that's a little utopian, but I do firmly believe that. And I don't really know why this is the case, but I think that the younger generation does offer us some cautious optimism as they continue to learn about different perspectives. They continue to learn how to communicate. They continue to learn about how to respect other people and other ideas. Then there is a chance that we may be able to get out of this current conundrum.
Well, certainly that's a long-term
yes.
sort of solution. Here we are in the holiday season. We are all going to be getting together for parties and holiday dinners and so forth. Do you have any advice on how, in the short term, to engage in more nuanced and respectful conversations?
Sure, absolutely. And I outline 20 practical suggestions in my book that anyone can employ.
20 practical suggestions for not getting punched in the nose
exactly,
this holiday
exactly.
season.
Exactly. A couple of them I've already mentioned, and that is remember that the other person is a human being. Don't go into it as if it's a competition. One of the other really important, I think, suggestions is to listen. To really listen. Try not to think about how you're going to answer the other person's argument, but actually listen to what they have to say and carefully think about it before you respond. Because chances are, when we're thinking about how to respond without necessarily thinking, we miss things and we might miss important points. And so I think listening is vital. Listening also shows respect. The other person is more likely going to listen to us if we listen to them. There are times when you may just want to avoid the conversation entirely. I don't think that that's particularly healthy for democracy. I think that we should have more conversations rather than less. But some people are pretty dogmatic. Some people are really set in their ways. It doesn't really matter what strategy you employ. If it's more than likely going to escalate into some sort of controversy or maybe even violent altercation, just step away. Folks went to Thanksgiving dinner. They're going to have Christmas and Kwanzaa, you know, dinners and that sort of thing during the holiday season. Families are going to get together. And if you can't have conversations with family members who theoretically are the people who are supposed to love you, then that speaks volumes about how we are as a society as a whole. I had a student just the other day who, after Thanksgiving, I asked her how it went. And she said, well, you know how sometimes you get into conversations about politics before dinner or after dinner? She says, well, in my family, we had one during dinner, and it escalated into an actual food fight. So it's those kinds of situations I would encourage people to just zip your mouth and let the whomever is ranting, let them rant and just avoid it altogether. I'm a firm believer in democracy, because if democracy doesn't work, or if that's not a viable option for us, then life, I think, would be very depressing. But if we want democracy to continue, if we want to enjoy the rights and privileges that we have in this country, we all have a part to play. It's supposed to be a government by the people and for the people. And every time we can sort of check out of politics or put our head in the sand or just say there's nothing we can do about it, we're abrogating that responsibility to people who are in positions of power. And we all, I think, owe it to ourselves as well as to each other to fight for what we really believe in, but fight in a very respectful and civically oriented way.
That's Joseph Zampetti, a professor of rhetoric and political communication in Illinois State University's School of Communication. His book is called Divisive Discourse. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Zampetti's book was originally released in 2015, and it's already going into its second printing. You can find it from Cognella Publishing. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. You know we should be mad love. So take a look what you've done. 'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. Hey! Now we got problems, and I don't think we can solve.
Bad Blood, Taylor Swift on Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. In this bewildering, information-drenched world, it can be difficult for people to recognize the differences between news and advertising, journalism and opinion, and bias and fairness. GLT's Colleen Reynolds caught up with Michael Spikes with the Center for News Literacy at Stony Brook University in Long Island, who is traveling Illinois to help educators with the tools they need to bring critical thinking to everything they see, read, and hear in the age of misinformation. Spikes says news literacy is about becoming an active and smarter news consumer.
When you come upon information, or you watch a news program, or you see something online that may purport to be news, before you go and you jump to a conclusion, after that story has ended, you really ask yourself a couple of questions. You ask yourself questions such as, what do I know at the end of this story? How do I know it? Who gave me this information? Who were the sources in that story? What may I not have heard in this story? And why I may not have known that information at the end of the story. So really, again, it's an active participation in the information that you consume. It does take a bit of work, but I think once you get into the habit of doing it on a regular basis, it becomes super easy to do. It becomes, as one teacher said to me, second nature.
How young can our students today who can understand what you're trying to teach them?
I would say it could go all the way back to primary school. We've seen in most cases that high school teachers are the ones that are mostly wrangling with the issues that we teach in our news literacy class, but we've also sort of felt that the sweet spot is middle school. Because in middle school, I used to work in the elementary school. My first job in education was actually as an elementary media specialist, also known as the librarian. And one of the things that I noticed with my fifth and sixth grade students, they were right on the cusp of development, in which they were developing their own points of view or having their own way of seeing the world. And we kind of feel like that sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade period, right around there, we really feel like that could be a real sweet spot of teaching news literacy, because it's right at the beginning of the time when young people are starting to really find out and understand who they are as people. And we feel like putting an intervention in that includes news literacy topics that will make them more skeptical of the information that they see is something that they can carry from that point through the rest of their life.
You refer to everyone today as a publisher. Explain that and why that's important to highlight.
So one of the things we talk about in our course are open platforms. And we look at social media as one of those open platforms, such as Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, YouTube. Yes, it's true that we go to social media too. I know personally, I use my Facebook page mostly as almost like a magazine. I have liked a couple of news outlets, and most times I get a number of articles there. But also at the same time, I can also publish my own material. A couple months ago, I was doing a series of blog posts for the BillMoyers.com blog, and I was doing some promotion on my own Facebook page. They promoted it on their Facebook page, and people were able to comment on those stories. So in these realms, again, going back to the idea of these open platforms have made communication not a one-to-many, but a many-to-many system, where now we as the consumer can also create and distribute to large numbers of people. With a platform like YouTube, there is no cost barrier to entry. Anyone, all they have to have is a computer or even just a cell phone. They can create a video, put it up on YouTube for free, and that goes out to the millions and millions of people who access that platform every single day.
So with that ability comes responsibility, but not everybody is exercising that. Thus, the need for consumers to be more savvy.
Right. That is exactly what we use in the class. We use the line from the first Spider-Man movie, and we say what Uncle Ben said to Peter Parker: with great power comes great responsibility. And we have to be more aware of the fact we spend a lot of time of telling young people that you put something on the internet and it will never disappear, right? So we have to understand what our responsibility is in using these open platforms. I would definitely encourage people to use them and to utilize them, because what these open platforms have done is they have given people who did not traditionally have a voice, a voice. So there are lots of things that you can find now and lots of groups of people that now you can congregate with and talk to about pieces of media that traditionally weren't out there. I know personally, I love old ephemeral films from like the 1950s and 60s, these old like newsreels and old educational films. But you're not going to find that on your cable network. You're not going to see a station with that. You can find lots of those videos on YouTube, and you find a very active community of people that are discussing these kind of videos, are posting those kind of videos, and so on. But also, with that being said, we've seen lots of occasions and lots of things where we've had nefarious players out there who have posted information, have posted misinformation, and have willingly put wrong things out there and have generated and created these communities where we've had folks that kind of run counter to our cultural norms, to what we understand, how we should live in a democratic society. And for all of us, we have to know what our role is, both as publishers of that information or even commenting on those kind of things, and also as consumers of that information. And we should be very mindful of what we're consuming, what we're seeing, what these things are, how we understand them to be.
And you spend a lot of time on the importance of vetting information, and that information alone is not journalism and can only be taken a certain way. It can be used to support a point of view, but certainly knowing the difference is important.
Right. One of the lessons that we teach the students: when you come upon something that looks like news, sounds like news, even something that might have an opinion in it, and we would kind of categorize it as journalistic opinion, we say make sure you put it through a V, I, and A filter. And that is, look for about pages on websites. Look for statements of purpose or mission statements from organizations that are distributing information. And then the A is accountability. And that's where we say, is the person responsible and answerable for the work they do? So is there a name connected to this information? Is there an organization that's behind that person that's writing that? And are they accountable for the information? Do they take steps to print corrections if a mistake is made? Because mistakes will be made. I mean, we're all human. Just because an outlet makes a mistake in their reporting, it does not mean that it's a mark of bias or a predisposition. It could just be we made a mistake. And are they upfront and honest about that? So again, what we say is use that simple VINA, verification, independence, accountability.
And that is more important today because of blurred lines. You talk about that quite a bit.
Yeah, we definitely talk about it. When coming back to that idea of these open platforms of Facebook, of Twitter, YouTube, and so on, we can definitely get this blurring of the lines. And when I talk about this blurring of the lines, I mean it between different categories of media. So how do I know what I'm looking at or what I'm watching? Is it journalism? Is it an advertisement? Is it promotion? Is it propaganda? Is it raw information? We talk about information that has not been vetted by any professional. So we would look at like cell phone videos, or we would say even just comments online. These are things that are just information that has been put out there by people we may not know who they are. So it becomes very important for us to think about what are the characteristics that we might see in each of these pieces of information. So for instance, one of the things we talked about in our class is something called native advertising, but they are made to look like the traditional pieces of media that are put on that particular outlet. So an example would be if you pick up your newspaper and you see a news story about climate change, what companies are doing to fight climate change. And what you see at the top is that this piece was sponsored by Shell or another oil company. That would be an example of a native ad. It looks like a news story. It was in your newspaper, but it was actually paid for by Shell. It was an advertisement. So there are many examples of this that are around. And one of the caveats that I make with this is that there may be some good information in those native ads, but it's very difficult for us to come to a conclusion based off of that one piece of media. So in this case, we would say it's a blurred line between advertisement and information that will help to inform us. So almost like journalism in a way. And we have to be very aware of that and keep our antenna up.
I'm Colleen Reynolds. You're listening to Sound Ideas, and we're talking with Michael Spikes, who is with the Center for News Literacy at Stony Brook University, but he's based in Chicago. You talk about truth, and we've heard phrases such as fake news, alternative facts, and then truth. How do you address truth in your teaching?
So in our course, one of the first things that I always say when I get ready to give our lesson on journalistic verification and the truth, as it seems to journalists, we do take a very methodical approach to understanding what the truth is in journalism, in the context of journalism. So one of the things that we say is scientists and journalists don't believe in a absolute truth. They're very hard to understand absolutes. So we do not look at the world, though journalists do not look at the world, and scientists do not look at the world in terms of black and white. Things are either or. Right. One of the lines that I use many times that comes from a psychology professor on our campus that says scientists learn to be comfortable living in the gray. We live in a very complicated world. We live in a democratic society, which is all about the debate of different ideas. But the way that we approach the truth, the definition that we use, is that it is a statement that is proportional to the evidence. And really, for journalists, I would add the words right now, because evidence that we have in front of us will present the truth as we know it right now. But sometimes we might find more evidence that might change our perception of the truth. So because of that, one of the vocabulary words that we use in the class is that the truth is provisional, meaning that as we gather more evidence, what we believe today could change tomorrow. So a prime example of this can come with the analogy we use in the class is hundreds and hundreds of years ago, people thought the earth was flat. More evidence arises, and what we believe the truth to be changes.
Some people might hear that and say, well, what about facts? Facts matter. Is what you're saying, does that run counter to that?
No, I wouldn't say that that runs counter to that. What I would say to that is we should always stay open to what the evidence will show to us. So there's the famous line from Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan that everyone is entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts. So we all want to start from a base set of facts, and those facts should be based off of evidence. So yes, there are some things in the world where we can say, we've studied this, we've discovered X, here is the fact.
Michael Spikes of the State University of New York at Stony Brook says his institution has used the news literacy course for more than 10,000 undergraduates and makes all of the materials available to any educator. He spoke with GLT's Colleen Reynolds following a session with teachers in McLean County. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal and WGLT.org. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from Charlie Schlenker, Ryan Denham, Laura Kennedy, and Colleen Reynolds. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Our email address is news@WGLT.org. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.